Hello and welcome to The X-Ray. I'm Fernando Espuelas in Washington, D.C. There are many fine journalists covering the political scene here, but there's one column I never miss. Greg Sargent in The Washington Post is deeply analytical, fantastically sourced, and always insightful. And last week, after the expulsion of two black representatives from the Tennessee state legislature for their involvement in a gun control protest, he wrote about what he calls the Fortress MAGA phenomenon. It's a provocative concept that helps explain what is going on in Donald Trump's movement. In a wide-ranging conversation, Greg and I explore this concept as well as other political developments impacting the emerging 2024 election. Greg Sargent, welcome to The X-Ray.
Thanks for having me on.
How does the expulsion of the two Democrats in Tennessee fit into the bigger picture of the MAGA movement?
Yeah, I think actually you saw a lot of news accounts and commentators describe this as unprecedented in its use of that particular mechanism. And I think that's undoubtedly true. It really is an outlier event in certain respects. But my worry has been that that actually erases a bigger part of the story here that's really essential, which is that in red states across the country, you've seen GOP-controlled legislatures seeking to use novel abuses of power to tamp down on the kind of unexpectedly ferocious resistance that their reactionary culture warring has unleashed. And I tried to fit that, what happened in Tennessee, into that frame, because that's really what was going on, right? Mm-hmm. Tennessee Republicans were reacting to an explosion of popular protest, which was, you know, really rooted in outrage over Republican misrule on guns after the shooting in Nashville. And so whatever you say about the conduct of the Tennessee Three and the two who were expelled, the bottom line was that they were really reacting to an outpouring of popular protest. And you see this sort of thing in other cases across the country, various uses of novel mechanisms and governing tricks and so forth to really squash dissent from the reactionary rule that's unfolding in those states.
And you've called this in the piece a retreat into Fortress MAGA. From your perception, what is Fortress MAGA and how does it manifest itself aside from Tennessee?
So in many of these states, obviously, the Republican-controlled legislatures were legitimately elected by popular majorities. These are red states, though we should say that in many cases, extreme gerrymanders have maximized the amount of power that Republicans have relative to the popular vote distribution in their states and so forth. But that said, right, there really is kind of a retreat behind these walls in these red states going on. I think the analyst Ron Brownstein put it very well when he said something like Republican legislatures are stacking sandbags against a rising tide. I find that to be a very helpful way of describing it, because while they're elected by popular majorities, they're using their power in additional ways to really try and enforce a kind of uniform reactionary orthodoxy throughout their states. So, for instance, they're using preemption, in which Republican legislatures deprive localities and counties and cities that are bluer within red states of governing themselves and interpreting laws and rules their way. For instance, you see Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida taking steps to fire a liberal-minded prosecutor and trumping up reasons for it that were basically invented. This is the type of thing we're talking about. The retreat into Fortress MAGA is the use of this extraordinary range of powers to try and enforce this reactionary orthodoxy within these states.
And even as that is happening, you also point out in a different column about the Supreme Court election in Wisconsin that there seems to be, at least at this stage, early indications that there was a surge in youth voting. The distance between the liberal candidate who won and the conservative candidate who lost, approximately 10 points, would seem to show some big movement in the electorate. Do you think that ultimately this Fortress MAGA strategy, if it is a strategy, essentially is counterproductive for Republicans? I mean, where are the new voters to create a majority come from?
Well, it's a mixed picture, right? Obviously, this is working for them within red states in a certain respect, right? And we should acknowledge that someone like Ron DeSantis has majority support in his state, right? Mm-hmm. That's something that I think liberals need to reckon with and understand. And we can't really sort of pretend that's not happening. But beyond that, I think there are ways in which this is highly counterproductive for the National Republican Party. To take Wisconsin, which you brought up, this is a state that Donald Trump won by less than a point in 2016, and that Joe Biden won by less than a point in 2020. Now you've got the liberal judge winning by around 11 points in really the most closely contested swing state in the upper Midwest. This is a state that is, you know, almost certainly going to be essential for Republicans to assemble a 2024 Electoral College majority. They probably can't get back Pennsylvania or Michigan, but they may be able to get back Wisconsin. So an 11-point blowout has to be sobering to Republicans, particularly since it was driven by two important things, Dobbs and also explosive youth turnout in response to that and other things. And so my theory of the case right now is that when these reactionary legislatures do their latest thing, you know, the latest crazy book ban, the latest insanely draconian abortion, anti-abortion ruling, anti-choice law, the latest restrictions on classroom discussions of race, sex, and gender, when they do that, these things tend to go viral. It's no longer the case that they're sort of confined to the local audiences. You follow Twitter as closely as anybody, and you see, you know, unfortunately, all these things tend to really suddenly explode. Right. They become national stories. And I've got to think that in the eyes of young voters who get their news this way a lot of the time from this type of viral content, they're getting a picture of the Republican Party nationally as being a really reactionary and destructive and unhinged force. And when you see something like that in Wisconsin, where the youth vote is driving an 11-point victory in an incredibly close swing state, you got to think that some Republican strategists worry about this emerging picture of the national party as really in the hands of crazed reactionaries.
And how do you see what are exclusively Republican moves to restrict voting rights fit into this picture? Is this part of a coherent strategy to essentially limit the franchise in order to be able to push more of these reactionary policies going forward? Or is that just part of a long-term trend that manifests itself almost every election?
Well, I think, yes, the voter suppression tactics, I think it's important to remember that they really got going in the wake of the 2010 Republican rout, where they won control of state legislatures across the country. Now, if you think back to that time, Barack Obama's victory in 2008 scared the heck out of a lot of Republicans. They saw this new emerging electorate, you know, the Obama coalition of young voters, college-educated whites, and minorities. And they said, we're facing some demographic troubles here. And so in 2010, you really saw an escalation, or in 2011, after Republicans won control of state legislatures, you saw an escalation in both gerrymanders and in voter suppression tactics. I mean, they had been around before, but they really escalated at around the time that Republicans started to really worry about the demographic long-term trends they were up against. And so, yeah, it's a longer-term picture, but I do think that the use of voter suppression tactics in places like Georgia, after Democrats won two Senate seats there in a shocker and won the presidential contest there, the use of these types of tactics in places like Georgia is very much a retreat into Fortress MAGA. It's the use of majority power to raise those walls against, again, to quote Brownstein, to stack the sandbags high against the rising demographic tide.
You also, in a recent column after the indictment of Donald Trump, you wrote that what was equally concerning, aside from the indictment itself, which broke precedent, but nevertheless not in an international context, many countries have prosecuted former leaders for corruption and other crimes. But you pointed out that the almost uniform defense of Donald Trump by Republican leaders was concerning in itself because it seemed to place Donald Trump in some special category outside of the law, almost as if even the premise of investigating and prosecuting him was problematic in itself, regardless of the facts. Can you go a little bit deeper into that? What do you think it actually means? Is it not just purely political tactics in the moment to try to keep the Republican base loyal to that particular leader? Or do you see it as something perhaps a little more ominous, as reflecting on some point of view or some almost decay in terms of support of the rule of law?
To be fair to Republicans, there is a range of positions on Donald Trump. Mitch McConnell has, I think, gotten too much praise for his willingness to break from Trump. In many respects, he was not willing to do so at the right moments, but his position is clearly different than, say, Kevin McCarthy's, and even more so than, say, Marjorie Taylor Greene's, right? There's a range. I mean, Mitch McConnell has been willing to squarely, belatedly, but squarely blame Trump for January 6th, for instance. And I don't think you know, from McCarthy, you don't get that, even though he said it privately. And from the MAGA Republicans who think January 6th was good, you certainly don't get it. But so that said, in this case, what troubled me, and I think a lot of other people, was that the Republican position on Trump's indictment wasn't just to criticize the strength or weakness, to criticize the weakness of the case against him, which would be a valid position to hold, right? Rather, what they were actually saying, if you looked at their comments and their tweets and so forth, they were saying that, in essence, any law enforcement activity involving Trump is inherently illegitimate. And so that seemed to me to be a declaration that Trump must be held above the law. Otherwise, they will essentially try to feed the anger of his supporters to the greatest extent they possibly can. In a way, their position, at least from some of them, was that the price of social peace will be complete impunity for Trump. And obviously, that's a pretty alarming prospect, that one of the two major parties took that position. And by the way, the larger context here is they have had years and years of off-ramps where they could have acknowledged the fundamental lawlessness and destructiveness of Trump's conduct and his corruption and so forth. And again, they refused to take that off-ramp, and they refused to do it even now, even when he faces the possibility of multiple criminal indictments.
You know, I read you every time you publish, so I love your column. But I feel your pain because there's so much wrong with our political system. So at the end of the day, when you're done, you're off Twitter, are you optimistic about our future?
Yeah, I got to say, so go back like a year or two, right? The sort of checklist I had in mind was Putin continues to lose the war in Ukraine. Law enforcement doesn't blink in the face of Trump's threats of mass violence and civil unrest. Bolsonaro loses in Brazil, and a big climate bill gets passed, right? Like I was saying to myself, two years ago, I was saying to myself, okay, if those four things were to turn out well, right, then I would feel a lot better than I otherwise might have felt about at where everything's going. Now, obviously, you know, that's just a very partial list, but those four things did go the way I had hoped. And while obviously what's happening in the Russia-Ukraine war is a horror and so forth and still up in the air, I got to think, I mean, I'd be interested to know whether you agree with me on this, but those four things going the right way were kind of a pleasant surprise.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think Bolsonaro, and I follow Brazil quite closely because I used to work there, and it was just an ever mounting horror. what's he going to do next? And I thought that was a tremendous signal as well. And I think the whole Ukraine-Russia war, which is a tragedy at many different levels, if you just step back and look at it a really cold-eyed, realpolitik kind of way, the fact is the Russian army is effectively defanged, at least for the next 5 years. At least that's what I'm reading. And that no one would have expected. I mean, the potentiality of Russian military power was the greatest weapon they had. And now that weapon seems to, at the very least, be blunted, right?
Yeah. And to add to that, right, I did a couple of interviews with Francis Fukuyama about this topic because he was out very early predicting a Ukrainian victory, which was not an easy thing to predict. And you know, I don't know if we know for sure what's going to happen there, but Fukuyama's point in our interviews, which I thought was really interesting, was that Russian failure here, or like partial to complete Russian failure here, has a galvanizing effect for liberal democracies, you know, across the West, because the entire premise of, or one of the premises of the Russian attack was that the Western liberal democratic alliance would crumble under real strain because it's decadent and self-involved and just a few high energy prices and the alliance would fall apart. But that's not happening. And so in Fukuyama's eyes, and I think he's probably right about this, on some level, Russian failure, even partial, really is a big moment for sort of reaffirming faith in liberal democracy going forward.
I think Finland's entry into NATO is transformative at many different levels. Symbolically, is a huge defeat for Putin, but on a functional basis, I mean, just, you know, almost like playing Risk here a little bit with real countries. The exposure of Russia's borders to NATO has increased dramatically, creating a new strategic dynamic that Russia, you know, essentially created for themselves. So it's, I think we're going to look back 5 years from now, and I certainly hope that the democracy of Ukraine is successful and they're able to liberate their people and their territory. We're going to see this as a, you know, a hinge moment in history. And it's very easy to see how Russia declines from here even further, right? And becomes essentially an energy colony of China.
Yeah, and also thinking about the future of the Republican Party here, it looks as if the Republican Party is still pretty divided on whether to fund the war effort, the Ukrainian defense effort going forward. But as far as it appears as of now, the supporters of funding it are prevailing. And I got to think that that becomes an important thing in Republican politics going forward. If this turns out well, or well is the wrong word, but if this turns out not as bad as it might have, then the Republicans who are on the right side of the funding question can really kind of further marginalize those who were in the kind of MAGA slash Putinist camp. And we all know who those are: Marjorie Taylor Greene, J.D. Vance to some extent, Tucker Carlson, although obviously he's a commentator. And I think that's maybe helpful domestically.
Yeah, as someone who grew up and who was a kid during the Reagan era, having Republicans support a Russian dictator is to me sort of a mind-blowing experience. And it really, you know, I can't even make sense of it. And I've had discussions with Republicans about this, and they're a little shocked themselves. I wonder how that plays out. I wonder, you know, the Tucker Carlson propaganda platform for Putin is so incomprehensible in the long march of Republican history. Is that where it's going, or is this just an aberration? I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, I think there's a real movement on the right, which is, I think you couldn't necessarily say that they're all Putinists. A lot of them are really kind of a little bit, really have serious reservations about Putin. I think someone like J.D. Vance, for instance, I wouldn't call him a Putinist, but he finds the right wing, what you might call the right wing authoritarian international, the post-liberal axis, right? He finds that seductive. And you know, the Orbanist types in the, I guess the conservative movements, it's not even the right term anymore because they don't really seem conservative. They seem like they're like a breed of right-wing populist with some conservative instincts, I guess. But for this whole kind of range of thinkers and politicians, this is that right-wing authoritarian international, the post-liberal international is a very seductive thing. And that's the context in which they seem to be reluctant to fund Ukrainian, Ukrainian resistance to Russian aggression, because on some level they don't like liberal democracy and they don't want it to prevail in this situation.
The other day, I spoke to Professor Michael Kazin from Georgetown, and I asked him, is the MAGA movement revolutionary? And he sort of laughed in my face and said, no, they're a reactionary right.
Yes, reactionary is the right term.
Yeah, and if you think about Putin's speech, right, even the symbology around Putin, which is all the imperial czarist symbology, the double-headed eagle and the crowns, and he's constantly having his picture taken next to statues of Catherine the Great and Peter the Great and all this kind of stuff. It is a backwards looking, you know, if only we had more of that czarist fun energy, you know, everything would be fine. The homophobia, the adoration of a single-minded ideology. I mean, all these things are backward looking. And it's interesting that there would be American politicians that look at that and say, yay, let's have more of that here. It's crazy. It's incomprehensible.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that doesn't make them Putinists, but they do despise liberal internationalism. One of their central and most cherished talking points is to say, you know, we have to care more about our border than we care about Ukraine's. And that's actually, when they say that, they're expressing a real worldview, a real serious and meaningful condemnation of liberal internationalism and liberal democracy. And I think we should take that seriously and not just treat it as some dopey talking point, even though it is pretty damn dopey. You know?
Absolutely. I was listening the other day to an interview with Robert Kaplan, the historian who wrote this book, essentially analyzing the 1920s and the U.S. lack of involvement in European politics. Mm-hmm. And in particular, the 1920s and 30s, and he mentioned how when the French occupied the Ruhr Valley, this industrial part of Germany, when Germany could not pay reparations, how the U.S. could have stopped that. And if it could have stopped that, it would have ended the cycle where essentially the German middle class lost all its savings because of hyperinflation, and how that essentially was a catalyst for Hitler, how that created a space for radicalism and then specifically Hitler to emerge. And his point was that there are moments in time where American intervention, not necessarily military intervention, but diplomatic intervention in world events can have this transformative quality, right? And I think Ukraine is one of those places where by defending the democracy in Ukraine, we're in fact defending Estonia, we're defending Finland, we're defending Portugal, we're defending the world and keeping our own armed forces from having to fight wars. And the lack of, I think, we have such a little orientation for foreign affairs among American voters in general that it's, you know, these things are almost like, what are you talking about? Why Ukraine and why not Alabama, right? Like, why are we spending money there and not here? I think it's politically, it's very powerful to denigrate, you know, the Ukrainians. In some sectors or some elements of the political right. But in fact, it's completely counterproductive to American interest.
Yes. And I think that our kind of homegrown Putinist types, or the ones who aren't quite Putinist, but are sort of in the J.D. Vance space of being really highly skeptical of investing in any of this stuff, defending Ukraine, they were also counting on the American electorate tiring of this very quickly and not being willing to support a faraway ally. And they were counting on, again, the decadence of liberal Democrats and liberal democracy to make that happen. And they've been really wrong about that. And that's really pretty great to see.
It certainly is. Let's, I think, an optimistic point to end. Greg Sargent from The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining the X-Ray today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. The MAGA movement represents one of the biggest challenges to American democracy since the Civil War. Its counterintuitive support of Putin, just as one example, breaks with a multi-decade consensus that America supports people and countries in their struggles against left and right-wing dictatorships. Philosophically, MAGA is a radical rejection of pluralism, diversity, and liberal democracy. And while it's too early to know how MAGA will impact the upcoming presidential election, there's no doubt that Donald Trump's movement is a potent populist force with tremendous capacity for disruption. I want to thank my guest, Greg Sargent, and also the production team, Nicole Legacy, Sydney Richards, and Renee Pineda. And I want to thank you for joining me on this episode of The X-Ray. I'm Fernando Espuelas. For more information on this podcast, check out thexray.org and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.
The X-Ray with Fernando Espuelas is an editorially independent production of Issue 1.